The family of Virginia Giuffre, who became the most prominent victim of Jeffrey Epstein, has told the BBC that Lord Mandelson should never have been given the position of UK ambassador to the United States. He was sacked from the job after it emerged he'd sent supportive emails to Epstein after his conviction for a sex offence. Lord Mandelson has denied any wrongdoing, and there's no suggestion he ever met Ms. Giuffre. But speaking on Sunday with Laura Koonsberg, Ms. Giuffre's sister-in-law, Amanda Roberts, said action should have been taken earlier.
Why does it take us to have to pull out the skeletons for people to be held accountable? Like, our governments have allowed these people to hold their status and their title, you know, without shame. And so part of me is like, we should have done something sooner. He should have never been given that title.
The Labour donor John Cordwell, who switched allegiances from the Conservatives before last year's election, has accused Rachel Reeves of being a lame duck chancellor. Mr. Cordwell, who founded Phones for You, told the BBC Ms. Reeves had delivered a very, very poor budget. The US Secretary of State Marco Rubio has repeated that he's unhappy about Israel's attack on Hamas leaders in Qatar last week as he arrived in Tel Aviv for a two-day visit. But he insisted relations between the US and Israel were still very strong. Ukraine's military says it's carried out a drone strike on one of Russia's largest oil refineries, southeast of St. Petersburg. Kyiv said the strike caused a large fire in the Kirishiv refinery. The Russian governor of the region said air defences had destroyed three Ukrainian drones and the fire was caused by falling debris. Police are trying to track down those involved in violence during yesterday's protest led by the far-right activist Tommy Robinson. At least 25 people were arrested in central London and several officers were seriously injured. The Brazilian multi-instrumentalist Hermito Pascoal has died at the age of 89. Known for his collaborations with Miles Davis, Pascoal was a prolific composer and orchestrator who was equally skilled on the flute, saxophone, keyboards and guitar. And the weather: outbreaks of rain will sweep from the southwest this afternoon, reaching the north and east. By the evening, temperatures reaching 14 Celsius in Belfast, 16 in Edinburgh, 17 in London and 18 in Cardiff. BBC News at 2 minutes past 12. Now it's time for Private Passions with Michael Barclay.
Mark Kermode began reviewing films 40 years ago and has established himself as one of our foremost critics, both in print and on air. He co-presents Screenshot on Radio 4 and the podcast Kermode and Mayo's Take with his long-term collaborator, Simon Mayo. He said he goes to every screening, hoping it'll be the next Citizen Kane, but he's also renowned for his energetic rants against the films he finds most disappointing. Music is another lifelong love, and for nearly 30 years, he's played double bass in the Dodge Brothers, a skiffle band who've also performed live soundtracks for silent movies. And film music is the subject of his most recent book, Mark Kermode's Surround Sound, examining the complex relationship between what we hear and what we see. You've brought us Albinoni, Strauss, Mika Levy, and Jelly Roll Morton. Why Jelly Roll?
Well, I kind of grew up surrounded by the sound of Jelly Roll Morton. My father was a really big music enthusiast, but he really loved old ragtime blues, New Orleans jazz, and Jelly Roll Morton. And he had this big gramophone player, and it was quite the thing. And it had this really complicated arm on it and these big speakers, you know, the size of shelving units. And he would play Jelly Roll Morton records. And I was kind of marinated in them. And that, to me, if I think back to my childhood, it is the sound of those records. He also used to collect 78s. And I used to love the fact he had one turntable that played 33 and 45. And I think it probably played 16. You remember, for speech records, yeah, it would be like, you know, a couple of hours or something. I loved the sound of those recordings. I loved how much he loved it. And I kind of imagined that everybody grew up surrounded by that. And then, you know, later on in life, I ended up being a big fan of rock and roll and skiffle and blues. And I kind of realized at a point that actually all the stuff I loved was sort of traceable back to the fact that my dad had really liked Jelly Roll Morton and those kind of recordings. The simpler, the better, the scratchier, the better, the more basic, the better. Can I tell you what I love about that? That one of the really deceptive things about blues and boogie-woogie is that it is, on the one hand, very, very structured and straightforward. Like, I remember the point that I realised that a huge amount of pop records were three chords. You know, it'd be E, A, B. And the 12-bar blues is, theoretically, it's those intervals repeated over and over again. But what's brilliant is what you do within that structure. And the thing that makes old blues, old boogie-woogie, old, you know, piano rags so fascinating is the really complicated, strange signature things that are done around the structure. And I am somebody who loves structure. That's what I love about those records.
You grew up in Barnet in North London, Mark.
Yes. We worked our way up and down the Northern Line. So when I was very young, we lived in Hampstead Garden suburb, and then we moved up to Finchley Central, and then we moved East Finchley, and then Totteridge. So my entire life was mapped out by that north end of the Northern Line.
Your mum was a GP?
Yeah, my mum was a GP, and she absolutely loved it. She practised in Golders Green, and she apparently was a really, really good GP. Since mum died, I've had people come up to me who were her patients and tell me what a great GP she was, and it's incredibly moving, because it's one of the things that you don't really realise at the time what your parents are doing. I mean, you know, I knew that mum was a GP and dad worked in the health service and he worked at London in Whitechapel. I knew that, but it was only afterwards with people saying she was a really, really good GP and she took it really seriously. She saw it as a calling and she loved doing it and she loved the personal interaction with the patients.
Do you remember the first film soundtrack that you heard?
Yes, I remember really, really clearly. My mum had taken me to see Dougal and the Blue Cat. It was the feature-length film of The Magic Roundabout, and I thought it was absolutely wonderful. And then afterwards, we were in Woolworths, and there was a soundtrack LP for Dougal and the Blue Cat. And I said, oh, you know, can we get it? And she said, well, it's like 99p. It was like maybe a pound or something. And she bought it, and I took it home. And it was the soundtrack, the whole soundtrack. I mean, minus a few bits, but all the narration by Eric Thompson, all the songs, all the music, the whole film. And I just thought that's what soundtrack albums were. I thought they were the whole film. It was only later that I discovered that soundtrack albums were the music from the film.
So did you then move on to LPs of movie music?
Yes, and I remember the way it happened really clearly was that I went to see 2001. It was a reissue of 2001, and me and my friend Mark First went to see it. And Mark First's mother had said to us, it's very symbolic. I had no idea what symbolic meant. We realised afterwards it meant incomprehensible. But we sat there in the cinema, and the film starts, and Alstrom's Black Zarathustra comes on. And we were just like, because that's such an amazing opening. We were pinned to our seats. And then I said to my mum and dad, can you get the soundtrack of 2001? And my dad knew what the theme music was. Everyone refers to it as the theme from 2001, but he knew it was Alstrom's Zarathustra. And then he brought it back home, and I played the opening of it, and it was exactly as I remember it in the film. But then there was like an hour and a half of music that I'd never heard before, but I fondly imagined was the soundtrack to the film, because I'd only seen the film once. This is in the days before video.
It was a masterstroke of Kubrick to use this, and he always has used very interesting music.
He has. It's a masterstroke to the point that we now all think of that piece of music as the theme from 2001. See, what I find really fascinating about that is, OK, so there's the opening, that's 2001, and then there's everything else, which is not 2001. But I remember so clearly, my dad had this pair of electrostatic headphones. It was literally like wearing two speakers on the side of your head. I mean, it was threatening to break your neck. And I think that's the first classical album I ever listened to all the way through. And I would read the Arthur C. Clarke novel of 2001, and I would put all that music that has nothing to do with the film on it.
We heard the opening of Also Sprach Zarathustra by Richard Strauss, performed by the Los Angeles Philharmonic under the baton of Zubin Mehta.
And that is exactly the album that I had, and thank you for getting that version, because I remember every single bit of it.
Isn't it wonderful the way the organ hangs over the last chord?
Yes, and then comes down and then comes back up again. Yeah, it's absolutely spine-tingling.
Tell us a little bit about school life, Mark Kermode. I think you went to the same school as the actor Jason Isaacs. Did you get to know him?
It's interesting. So we went to Haberdashers and we were both Direct Grant students. And when I was at school, I thought that Jason was the coolest guy in school. I kind of had like a schoolboy crush on him because he was so fabulous. He was the first person to swear in an English class. He was the first person to have a skateboard. He and I weren't friends because, you know, I sort of looked up to him. Years later, we became friends, which we are now. But we discovered something, which was that neither of us were who the other person thought we were. I thought that he was really cool. And actually, he tells me now that he had come down from Liverpool. He was very worried about the fact that his accent didn't fit in. So he learned to adjust his accent. He was actually very lonely, I think. And he thought that I was cool, which I find absolutely incomprehensible, because he thought I was in bands and I was always in bands. That was the thing that I did. You know, I mean, I have very, frankly, unhappy memories of being at school, other than the times that I was in bands. But it was just really fascinating to discover that the one thing that we had both learnt to do at school was to pretend to be other people. And, I mean, now, one of the reasons he's such a brilliant actor is because, I mean, that is what acting is, pretending to be another person. Now, I still can't quite believe the fact that I'm friends with Jason Isaacs, not because he's a famous movie actor, but because when I was in English class at the age of 11, he's the person I would have most wanted to be friends with.
You described yourself as an awkward kid. Does that mean you were bullshit?
No. I mean, I was, well, as you probably know, I've always had a loud voice, which has got me into a lot of trouble. I was weedy at school. I was rubbish at sports. I'd never been in a fight in my life. I got beaten up a few times. I had a habit of putting my foot in it. I was kind of the class idiot, I suppose. And I discovered quite early on, as a lot of people do, that there's two ways of getting around that, which is either you make people laugh or you join a band. And when you're in a band, you're in a gang. And then it's fine because that's the thing that you do. So I think I was difficult. I remember in later life apologising to my parents for what an unpleasant teenager I was. I complained all the time about, I felt like a fish out of water. But that was partly to do with the fact that I hadn't yet discovered the things that made me happy, that I was able to do. You know, the things I love are playing music and watching films. And back then, I was told an awful lot of stop watching films, learn to speak properly, do the things you're meant to do. And when I discovered that actually watching films and not speaking properly, I could make a living out of, that was really when everything started to get better.
You made your own guitar, didn't you?
Yeah, I built a guitar in Practical Design. It was a magazine called Everyday Electronics, and they had a design for an electric guitar, and it was meant to take, you know, a couple of weeks to build. It took me 2 years because I was really, really cack-handed. I remember once our Practical Design teacher, who was a very good teacher but quite a scary guy, I was chiseling the frets out of the neck of the guitar. And he came over and he said, you're having a hard time with that, aren't you? And I said, yes. He said, do you know why? I said, no. He said, because that's a screwdriver.
Now, around that time, one of your favourite films was Silent Running. For those who don't know it, just tell us a little bit about what it is.
Silent Running was directed by Doug Trumbull, one of only a couple of features that he made. He had worked special effects for Kubrick on 2001. His father had done special effects on The Wizard of Oz. He'd been responsible for the flying monkeys, you know, the terrifying flying monkeys. And he made this incredibly sentimental science fiction film starring Bruce Dern on a deep space spaceship that's got the last remaining forests of Earth in these huge geodesic domes because Earth has become polluted. And he has, as his only companions, these little walking robots, these drones who don't speak, but they've got incredible personalities. And it's got this beautiful score by Peter Schickele. And these lovely songs by Joan Baez. I was taken to see it again with Mark First, with whom I'd seen 2001. But I sat behind somebody who was much taller than I was. And in order to see the screen, I had to lean over. And I remember watching the whole of that film, literally leaning over almost into the aisle to see the movie. And it's an indication of how great the film is that I just loved it. That piece of music, I think, was the first piece of music I ever realised that I loved the bass. Because the bass guitar in that dum 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 dum, and then it does that dum dum dum, that weird little move. And I remember listening to that and thinking that the bass is actually carrying the sort of the melancholy part of it. And then I've spent my life as a bassist.
The bass is really the root of all good and evil in music.
I have this t-shirt that was bought for me by a friend which says stay out of treble. And I started playing the bass because I was really bad at playing other instruments. I'm very, very clumsy. I broke lots of musical instruments. I was meant to learn the piano, but I was very bad at it. However, I did learn how to play the theme from 2001 on the piano. And I remember my piano teacher had a concert. It was around at her house in Finchley, and then all the people there would all play nice pieces of music. And then they said, and now Mark is going to play the theme from 2001. Boom, 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 boom. I remember looking in horror as I was playing this little thing, bang, 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 bang. But of course, you know, playing a bass, and particularly a double bass, but double bass is basically a wardrobe with strings, you know, you can't break it. But yes, the bass is the thing, isn't it? It's the heart of everything.
It reduced you to tears, that piece, didn't it, when you first heard it?
Even now, I mean, just listening to it just then, I was kind of... Because there's something about the quality of her voice. You know, I met Joan Baez once. I was doing a programme for Radio 4. I think it must have been Front Row. And I went in and Joan Baez was in the studio. And then I had to do the film review, which I made a complete horlicks of because I was overwhelmed by the fact that it was Joan Baez. Anyway, then at the end of the show, I was fell on my knees and went, Joan Baez. And she was like, what's going on? I said, I love Silent Running. And she looked at me and she went, Silent Running? I went, yeah, you know, Silent Running, Rejoice in the Sun. And she went, oh, yeah, yeah. Never saw it. Was it any good?
We heard Rejoice in the Sun, composed by Diane Lampert and Peter Schickley, performed, as you've just heard, by Joan Byers. Mark Kermode, you headed to the University of Manchester, didn't
yes.
you? And what did you study there?
I did English. I got rejected at first, so I wasn't sure that I was going to university. And I finally got into Manchester through clearing a year later. And I really wanted to go to Manchester, partly because I wanted to put 200 miles between me and my, you know, as many people do, you know, you want to sort of reinvent yourself. And also because I loved the pop music that was coming out of Manchester. And English was the thing I was at least passably good at. I loved being in Manchester. I ended up being there for 6 years because I ended up doing my PhD there as well. And it was this incredibly thriving culture. There was loads of sort of countercultural stuff going on. I started working at the magazine, their City Life, which was a workers' co-op. And that was really how I started getting into journalism. I mean, I remember walking into City Life and they sort of had this kind of open door policy that if you really wanted to do, I said, I want to write film reviews. They said, well, we don't need a film reviewer, but we do need a van driver. Have you got a clean driving license? And I did. So I started driving the City Life van. I did then trash the City Life van. And they then decided that I could probably do less harm behind a desk. But loads and loads of vans, everybody borrowing each other's equipment, some people stealing each other's equipment, 7-8 cinemas that you could get to on the bus. Things were pretty cheap. It was a fantastic time. Absolutely loved it.
Your PhD thesis was on horror fiction, wasn't
yes.
it? And that's really been an abiding passion for you.
Yeah, horror is sort of my kind of first love. I remember when I was a kid, I used to sneak down and watch the Monday X film on ITV with the volume turned down so that my parents couldn't hear I was watching. And I watch old Hammer reruns. And the world divides into two kinds of people, people who love horror and everyone else. And quite often you get asked, well, what is it about horror? And my answer is always, it's like, what is it about opera? You either do or you don't. It's not something that you can explain or something that you can... And a lot of people, I don't like horror films. I don't want to be scared. Okay, fine. That's great. The difference is that nobody thinks there's anything wrong or sick or twisted about loving opera. And quite often in the 1980s, there was the whole video nasties stigma. There was this kind of idea that horror movies were bad for you. Horror movies weren't bad for me. They were really good for me. And particularly when I was young, horror movies spoke to me and they gave me a sense of identity. And then I started going to late night screenings and you'd meet this community of people who shared the slightly offbeat, the forbidden, the stuff that was a little bit hidden possibly. And, you know, I used to write for Fangoria magazine, which is this American horror publication, and it became a joke. So if you meet Mark, how long will it be before he tells you that he worked for Fangoria? I mean, how long have I been here? 25 minutes. I've told you that I work for Fangoria magazine. Why? The reason is because it's one of the things I'm most proud of, because Fangoria magazine was the Bible of horror.
The next piece of music has possibly been rather overused.
Yes, Albinoni's Adagio. It brings together a couple of threads. So you mentioned that I was at school with Jason Isaacs. Jason went to see Rollerball, despite the fact that he was too young. And then he came to school and he'd invented a game called Rollerball. And it involved a bike, some roller skates and a rolled up jumper and people fighting, as far as I remember. But it was just the idea of he's been to see Rollerball. Anyway, I went to see Rollerball a little bit later on. It must have been reissued because I didn't dare when I was 12. Now, I had never heard this piece before. And I saw the film and there's a scene in it in which James Caan's character is basically having the memory of his loved one wiped. And this piece of music plays over it. And I remember saying I was asked, you know, what I'd like for my birthday. I said, can I have the Rollerball soundtrack? And everybody thought that you want the Rollerball soundtrack because you want da 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 da, which begins it.
Oh, but no, to Carter yeah. and do you want it?
No, I wanted it because of this piece that goes da 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 da, and I remember singing it and played it over and over. And then it started turning up in everything, and it became so overused that by the time it turns up in Kenneth Lonergan's Manchester by the Sea, it was like, you can't use that piece of music anymore. I mean, I was almost kind of embarrassed to put it down as a choice because it's so cliched. But I remember the first time I heard it. I remember seeing James Caan having these images of this person that he loved deleted on the TV screen while he listens to this. And it really, really affected me. And of course, famously, you correct me if I'm wrong, it's not composed by Albinoni.
No, we think it was the work of a 20th century musicologist and a biographer of Albinoni called Remo Giazzotto. But here it is. Of course, it's almost like a Procol Harum white, a shade
it
of
is.
Pale, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Thank you. just had an awful thought. If that is the work of Remo Giazzotto, and we think it is,
yes,
but it's always put down as being by Albinoni, do you think he hasn't had any royalties at all?
It's like that famous thing, everything you know is wrong. You know, it's like, what do you mean Albinoni didn't write that piece of music?
We heard it played there by the London Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Ben Gernon. Mark, your long broadcasting collaboration with Simon Mayo began at Radio 1. Is it possible to say what you made of him at first?
So the way it happened was, I was working at Radio 5 before it was 5 Live, and Simon had decided that he wanted a film reviewer on his Radio 1 show, and Matthew Bannister had said to him, well, we've got this bloke who's working on Radio 5, we'll put you in a room together and see what it's like. And my memory of it is this. They put me in a room with Simon Mayo, and I thought, that is my future. I need to shackle my wagon to his star and hang on for dear life. And I am absolutely clear about the fact that had it not been for that, for Matthew Bannister doing that and for Simon being the brilliant broadcaster that he is, I would never have had the broadcasting career that I've had because, as you've probably noticed, I tend to be very nerdy. I talk too fast. I talk too much. And what I got with Simon was somebody who go, hang on, yeah, what? Sorry, stop. What's that? What's that? What's that? And when I was broadcasting with Simon, I realised that, you know, that broadcasting adage that you're meant to make everybody think that you're talking to them. Well, Simon has got an audience of millions of people who all think that he is talking to them. And the way it worked with me and Simon is that I talk to him and he talks to the audience. And I have learnt more from working with him than anyone. Also, it helps that he's an incredibly decent person. You know, we've kind of been in a broadcasting marriage for a long time.
I was just about to say.
But it does feel like that. And we have very sort of clearly defined roles. But he is, in my opinion, one of the great broadcasting voices of our time. And he made me palatable. And I'm very aware of that.
You also worked for BBC Two's The Culture Show, and it was while you were interviewing the filmmaker Werner Herzog for that series that he got shot, albeit with an air rifle.
Yes. Well, to hear Werner talk about it now, you'd think he was shot with a howitzer. But, I mean, what happened was we'd gone to his house, and Werner said, no, I don't want my house to be in the thing because I attract crazy people. So he said, but if we go up the top of Lookout Mountain, there's a sort of promontory which we can stand on. And we were standing on this promontory and Werner was saying, well, in Germany, I've left a paved road. Nobody cares about my films. And suddenly there was this little explosion in the top of his trouser area. And he looked down and he went, oh, someone is shooting at us. We should probably leave. And of course, I grew up in Barnet, right? The idea that someone is shooting at us, we should probably leave, you figure? And then the next thing is, this is all on film, us hanging onto a fence trying to get out of the way. And Werner is just like, oh, like this is the sort of stuff that happens all the time. And then we got him back to his house and I said, look, can we have a look at it? Because, you know, he was injured and he opened his trousers and he had this, there was a hole. It went through his clothes and it went through his boxer shorts and it went into his abdomen. And I said, Werner, you've got to go to hospital. You've been shot. And he said, oh, it is not a significant bullet. I said, you know, I've been shot at in the jungles of Peru. This is it. And that was his whole thing, was it wasn't a significant bullet. And then years later, I said to him, did you ever have the pellet removed? He said, no. And I said, does it ever hurt? He said, no, it is not painful unless I laugh very enthusiastically and then I get a searing pain in my abdomen.
Music from Under the Skin next.
Yes, this is music by Mika Levy. I think Mika Levy is one of the most extraordinary composers working at the moment. I first came across Mika Levy's work through Under the Skin. And that film is a film about an alien on Earth, sort of inhabiting a human skin and trying to find out where they belong and somehow becoming almost infected by their humanity. And I think this piece represents the dawning of emotion. I remember hearing Mika Levy talking about it. They said that it was really about being a teenager, feeling awkward in your skin and trying to figure out who you were. And I thought that this piece of music just perfectly captured that.
Thank you. One of the things I wanted to ask you, having just heard that, Mark Kermode, is that music, when allied to a visual image, has an extraordinary potency that means that sometimes people can get into very avant-garde sounds which they wouldn't like in the concert hall, if you think Psycho and the strings playing on the back of the bow. Is that something which interests you?
Yes. You know, films are a gateway drug for music. All the way through my life, I have been introduced to really interesting experimental work through film soundtracks. In that particular case, that weird, that kind of the bend, the rise. Now, that feels to me physical. That feels like the kind of intake of breath. And when you watch Under the Skin, the visuals of it are very, very powerful. And so when I listen to that piece of music, I remember what I was seeing when those things were connected. And I think that if the film is working, the combination of sound and vision means that you become very, very open to very, very experimental, very avant-garde music.
Presumably, you grew up in the era of people like Barry Norman, Clive James, when critics were extremely powerful, because there was only 3 television channels and a limited range of newspapers and magazines. But now I suppose everyone is a critic.
Well, or are they? I mean, Barry Norman, for all of us, he was the high watermark. In terms of American critics, my great idol is Roger Ebert, who said that cinema is a machine for generating empathy, which I thought was just a beautiful way of summing it up. Nowadays, yes, there is social media and everybody has access to criticism, but the difference is this. You need to know where an opinion comes from. So if Barry Norman said, I like this film or I don't like this film, you go, OK, well, I know what else he's seen. I know what else he liked. And he was always very good at contextualising. And same with Roger Ebert. If some random person on Instagram says, I love this film, say, OK, great. Who are you? And what else have you seen? You know, people say, I saw that Jurassic Park. That was the worst film I've ever seen. No, it wasn't. You come to my house. I'll show you Oversexed Rug Suckers from Mars. That is the worst film you've ever seen. Yes, it's easier to be heard, but it's also much harder to have an impact. And I think it's much harder for aspiring critics. Now, when I started as a critic, I earned a living very early on. I got paid for reviews from the very first time I started writing them. Nowadays, it's very hard to get paid for your work. And I think that's the toughest thing.
You are well known for the intensity of your rants, positive and negative. They earned you quite a cult following. In fact, you spoke about the film Pirates of the Caribbean for no less than 11 minutes without interruption, saying, never was a film more accurately named. If you pay money to go and see Pirates of the Caribbean, it's your own fault, and you're bringing down the collapse of Western civilization.
I was a younger man. I mean, here's the thing. Look, I'm 62 now. People say, oh, you know, he's gone soft. Well, of course, you mellow as you get older. I know that some people think my voice is incredibly annoying, to which my answer has always been, imagine what it's like for me. I live with it. But that, I find it quite hard to experience things in moderation. And there came a point when I became less interested in talking about what I didn't like and more interested in what I did like.
And I think it's more difficult and more challenging, actually, to be positive in a way.
I agree. Than
negative. So what is your favourite film?
Of all time.
Of all time.
The Exorcist. And it has been since as long as I can remember. I saw The Exorcist when I was 17 years old, but it came out when I was 11. So I had 6 years of obsessing about it before I saw it. I remember going to the Classic in Hendon to see another film, and there were nuns sprinkling holy water on people as they went into the cinema, and there was a St. John's ambulance brigade because people were being carried out from fainting. And I remember the news stories, you know, should it be banned? And I remember reading the novel, which was passed around furtively in school. By the time I saw that film, I knew it off by heart, and I hadn't seen a frame of it. And then I saw it, finally, in the Phoenix in East Finchley, on a double bill with Ken Russell's The Devils, which was quite the double bill. And it was everything I had wanted it to be and more. It scared the living daylights out of me, but it also was an astonishing piece of work. And then I can say this quite honestly with my hand on my heart, and my wife Linda would back this up. There is not a day of my life that goes by that I don't think about that film at least once. When we got married, One of the things that we did on our honeymoon was that we went to Georgetown, which is where The Exorcist was filmed, because I wanted to walk around the set. And I lost count of how many times I've seen it. I ended up making documentaries about it and writing books about it.
Your documentary, The Fear of God,
yes,
25 years of The Exorcist, revealed how dedicated Mercedes McCambridge was to creating the voice of the demon in that film.
Yes.
Tell me a little bit about the kind of lengths she went to make it so very disturbing.
Well, what happened was that she felt that she had to embody the torture of the demon trapped in this body. She would swallow pulpy eggs and apples and then regurgitate them. She started smoking again to make her throat thick. They tore up bed sheets and tied her to a chair so it sounded like she was like in this demon wrestling this thing. And I went to interview Mercedes McCambridge, who's very, very small, you know. I said, well, how did you do the voice? And she said, well, the thing is, you know, it's not there anymore, but and then she suddenly like did this thing, and then she said, well, it's not there anymore because I had to do all this other stuff. It's not there, no, Mercedes, because she had the most extraordinary vocal range. And Billy Friedkin said that this thing would happen, weird double and triple sounds would come out of her language, like, you know, the multitude of spirits that you would imagine. It was an extraordinary, an absolutely extraordinary performance.
Your love of The Exorcist is almost religious, really. And in fact, it is a religious piece we're going to next. A rather extraordinary piece, too, by Orlando di Lasso, known to many of us as Lassus.
Yes, well, you say known to many of us. This is a perfect example of but not me until I saw it as the end title music on the film that became known as Exorcist 3. And as you know, if you're interested in finding out what a piece of music is in a film, you have to wait till the very, very end. It's the thing that comes after they've done the clapper loader in the insurance company and the driver and the driver's driver and the assistant to the driver, the very, very end of it. It's the music credits. And I discovered this piece of music, which I think is just transcendent.
Thank you.
It's just, it's breathtaking, isn't it? It's just absolutely, there's something about it. It makes the, you know, the hair stand up on the back of your neck. But it's so moving.
It conjures up wonderful spaces, doesn't it? Almost sort of cathedral-like.
Yeah, absolutely wonderful.
Lagrime di San Pietro, The Tears of St. Peter, composed by Orlando di Lasso and performed by the Gallicantus Ensemble, conducted by Gabriel Crouch. You're listening to Private Passions, where my guest this week is the film critic Mark Kermode. Where did you meet your wife, Linda Ruth Williams, Mark?
I met Linda at Manchester University. I was doing my PhD and she was doing a fellowship at Manchester. I mean, I remember it really clearly because you had to do a presentation every now and then to demonstrate that you were actually doing the PhD. And I remember Linda walked in the back of the room. And I mean, my memory of this is it was just love at first sight. And she came up to me, this just incredibly beautiful woman. And she said, "It seems to me that your thesis is haunted by Freud." And I thought, "I love you more than anything in the world." And, you know, I just remember that's how I remember it. She'll probably tell you there's a completely different version of it, but that's how I remember it.
You have two children together.
Yes.
And your recent book is dedicated to them.
Yes.
And I wonder how they've informed your taste in film.
Well, it's certainly true that when you have kids, you suddenly are open to a whole new generation of stuff. For example, I love the Twilight movies. And I know that critically they get sneered at and sniffed at and all the rest of it. And I know that one of the reasons I love the Twilight movies is because I watched them with my daughter, who was exactly the right age to get them. And I saw how profoundly affecting they were. I watched Mary Poppins with my kids about 100 times. And I went from thinking that it was a good film to thinking it was probably the greatest film ever made. My kids both, they're not kids anymore, they're adults now, both play music. And I've been exposed to a huge amount of music that I would never have been exposed to had it not been for them. And your kids challenge you to not shut down.
Well, that's one of the things I find about doing this programme, actually, is that you're introduced to things that you may not have come across. Yeah. And the next piece, actually, is a good example of that.
This is the music for Drive My Car by Eiko Ishibashi, a really wonderful composer. And I wasn't crazy about the film, but I really, really liked the music. And then through the miracle of the internet, of which I'm deeply suspicious, I managed to track down Eiko Ishibashi and send her a message and say, you know, look, I love this. Could you maybe tell me a little bit about how you did the writing? And she wrote me back a message. She said, oh, yeah, absolutely. I'm so glad you like it. Then as we're recording this show now, I'm just back from Croatia, a film festival I went to in Croatia. And one of the guests there was a music editor, a very celebrated music editor. Somebody asked her who she listens to now, and she mentioned Mika Levy, who we heard from earlier on. And she said, and there's this amazing composer called Eiko Ishibashi. And I literally jumped out of my chair and went, yes, she's incredible, isn't she? She's fantastic. But I think the music provides the emotional connection in Drive My Car.
Thank you.
It's almost ambient airport music, but airport music in the sense of the Brian Eno airport music, not background music. It sounds like it's kind of, oh, it's a bit chicken in the basket going on in the background, but actually it's so profound and so touching, and yet it's so deceptively in the background. I just think it's an astonishing work.
Well, I was listening to it with your ears in a way, and the bass was taking me to rather unusual harmonic places.
Yeah. And it's the heartbeat of music, isn't it?
We'll Live Through the Long, Long Days and Through the Long Nights, composed by Eko Ishibashi, from the original soundtrack of Drive My Car. How did you get involved with your current band, the Dodge Brothers?
So the Dodge Brothers came about because I was really interested in skiffle, and I'd been in a band called the Railtown Bottlers while I was in Manchester. It was a skiffle band. We ended up being the house band on Danny Baker's TV show on BBC One. Anyway, then I was with Linda, and Linda went to visit a friend of hers, and the friend of hers' husband was Mike Hammond, who is a film professor and an incredible expert on early cinema. Linda and Mary started talking shop, and Mike said, oh, you want to go next door? I got a piano. He went next door and he had a classic American songbook. I said, oh, you interested in old blues? He said, yeah. What do you like? And by the time Linda and Mary had finished their conversation, we'd formed a band. And and I had this whole thing that, look, all you need to form a band is you need seven songs, because seven songs is a gig. So we figured out seven songs. We got a harmonica player in, and it became skiffle, Americana, bluegrass. And we just love that music. And at one point, we went to Sun Studios in Memphis and we recorded an album, which, of course, the way you have to do that is no overdubs. You do it exactly as they would have done it. And it's just that kind of old-fashioned sound. And then the thing that changed our life was Neil Brand, who, as you probably know, is like the great silent movie pianist and composer of our age. Neil said, I want to start accompanying movies, silent movies, but not with just me on a piano, but with the band. And I said, OK, but how are we going to do it? He said, well, we'll just improvise. And I said, well, how's that going to work? I mean, if you improvise, your left hand is connected to your right hand through your head. But I mean, how is five people going to improvise? And he went, well, we'll just figure it, because it's what they used to do. And we started doing silent movie accompaniment with Neil to films like Beggars of Life and City Girl. And what we do is we follow Neil. As long as I can see Neil's left hand, I know what key he's in. And it has been one of the great joys of my life. And it's washboard, drums, banjo, guitar, double bass, harmonica, all old period instruments. And I seriously think that when the history of silent film music is written, Neil Brand's name will be up there in life, because he understands silent cinema in a way that no one I have ever seen does. He literally looks at the screen, his hands go on the keyboards, and he just plays the movie. It's astonishing.
This next track, I think, is one of your very favourites.
Yeah, this is a Washboard Sam track. And the reason this is important to me is, I said to you earlier on that, you know, my dad loved Jelly Roll Morton records, and I liked all this other stuff. You know, I grew up with punk and Concert Angels and things like that, which he wasn't particularly fond of. But we discovered that we sort of met in the middle with jug band washboard music. And one day my dad bought me a Washboard Sam record, and I loved it. And he did as well. And you know that moment when generationally you both go, oh no, we both think this is great. And then over the course of a series of years, he bought me the entire Washboard Sam recordings. And I just think of it as the point at which our very different interests in music met, which was Who Pumped the Wind in My Donut by Washboard Sam.
Who pumped the wind in my donut? Sure resemble me. Who pumped the wind in my donut? Sat on that yam yam tree. I wasn't there when the pumping was done, but whosoever pump a pumping, son of a gun. Who pumped the wind in my donut? Sure don't resemble me. Who pumped the wind in my donut? Sure don't resemble me. Who pumped the wind in my donut? Down on that yam yam tree. I like my donuts nice and sweet, but everybody tastes them up and down the street. Who pumped the wind in my donut? Sure don't resemble me. Did it, Down on that yam yam tree. I like my donuts nice and round, but everybody tastes them all over this town. Who pumped the wind in my donut? Sure don't resemble me. Down on that yam yam tree. Now my donuts, they are hard to beat. You eat free there, you can't stand on your feet. Who pumped the wind in my donut? So don't resemble me. Down on that yam yam tree. I got donuts all in my house. You eat my donuts, they'll melt in your mouth. Who pumped the wind in my donut? Sure don't resemble me. Now who pumped the wind in my donut? Sure don't resemble me. I don't know who did it, but whosoever did it, there was a popping sun was gone. Who pumped the wind in my donut? Sure don't resemble me. Who pumped the wind in my donut? Down on that yam yam tree. I wasn't there when the popping was done, but who's gonna ever pump a pumping son of a gun? Who pumped the wind in my donut? Sure don't resemble me.
Everything about that record makes me feel happy.
Who Pumped the Wind in My Donut, composed by Robert Brown and performed by Washboard Sam. Mark Kermode, your recent book, Surround Sound, traces how film scores have evolved over the years. When did the idea of the music becoming central to the theme or mood of the film come about, do you think?
Well, the most important thing is that film has never been silent. You know, as we were saying about working with Neil Brand, silent film was never silent. From the very first moments that people played short reels, movies have always had music with them. It is an essential part of the experience of watching the moving image.
A slight disagreement next, okay. Mark, because like many people, you didn't enjoy Stanley Kubrick's 1999 film Eyes Wide Shut, calling it the inane ramblings of a man who needed to get out more. But you have chosen some music from that film. It's not the music I loved, which is the Ligeti, almost single note.
Bong!
Bong.
Yes.
But it's music by Jocelyn Pook, I think, that you want.
So what happened was that Jocelyn Pook was brought on by Stanley Kubrick because they were using a piece that she had written when they were choreographing a sequence. And Stanley Kubrick got in touch with her and he said, I would like you to do some music for the film. And I interviewed her and she said that working with him was extraordinary because he was so interested, so informed, really knew what he wanted, what he didn't want, but he was also phenomenally secretive. And so she was working from scenes that she was working on, but nothing else. And at some point she said, look, I have to know more about what else you're using so that I know whether I'm a counterpoint to it or an accompaniment to it or whatever it is. And in the end, they developed a level of trust and she was given access to more material. But her experience of working with Stanley Kubrick on the film was entirely positive. And she said it wasn't until she saw the film and her music was in it that she knew that her music was in it, because Stanley Kubrick did have a habit of just saying, yeah, I won't use that.
Well, from the film, this is Masked Ball. Oh, That's why I like the film, because it prompted that music.
Yes. One thing I would say is this. Any film critic's opinion of a film will change over time. And I should probably go back and watch Eyes Wide Shut again. I still think that I will find it extremely flawed.
Yeah.
But I think the one thing that we can all agree on is that Kubrick's music decisions were intuitively brilliant.
Masked Ball by Jocelyn Pook from the 1999 soundtrack to Eyes Wide Shut. Do you think that film can survive? Some critics paint a rather bleak picture for the future of Hollywood, knocked by strikes, by franchise fatigue, with too many sequels and by risk aversion. How do you see it?
Throughout my life, and I'm 62 now, I have many times been told cinema is dead and film criticism is dead. You know, the arrival of television, oh, that's going to kill cinema. The arrival of video in my lifetime, oh, that's going to kill cinema. The arrival of streaming, oh, that's going to kill cinema. None of it has. It's changed, but none of it's killed it. I don't know how things are going to pan out, but what I do know is that I can cite several times, when Roger Ebert died, the papers were full of, that's it, that's the end of film criticism. He was the last film critic. Barack Obama said, cinema will not be the same anymore. Extraordinary that an American president would be that knowledgeable about cinema, and fantastic that he did. It wouldn't happen nowadays. But it isn't ending. It may be changing, but I think that there is a future because people still want to do that thing about watching moving pictures, telling stories communally. I don't think that's going away.
It's music from the film Never Let Me Go Next, a great novel and a great film, I think.
Based on... glad, because many people don't like that film.
Yeah, based on Ishiguro's
novel. Yeah.
The premise of the film is quite haunting, isn't it?
Well, it is a science fiction story, although there's an argument to be had about that. It is about young people who are living this very protected life in which they have to stay healthy, although they all appear to die young, and you realise gradually that they are clones who are being kept alive as spare parts. And it is a dystopian alternative future vision. But crucially, the score for it by Rachel Portman is brilliant because it is not a science fiction score. It is not a dystopian future score. It is a score about young people falling in love and experiencing life and coming of age. Doing the book, we had the great privilege of speaking to Rachel Portman, and the thing that she said was, I always saw it as a film about how we love and how much time we have. And she said, that is a universal human thing that is not science fiction.
That's a nice moment, I have to say. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you for having me.
Comode,
it's been a real pleasure.
As we listen to We All Complete by Rachel Portman.
We All Complete by Rachel Portman from the 2010 film Never Let Me Go. The final choice of Michael Barclay's guest on Private Passions, the film critic Mark Kermode. The programme was produced by Claire Walker. Next week's guest will be the psychologist and vice-chancellor of Cambridge University, Deborah Prentice. You might also like to know that the composer of the music we just heard, Rachel Portman, was Jess Gillam's guest on This Classical Life yesterday. You can find that episode on BBC Sounds.
Enjoying the BBC Proms? Experience unique performances you won't hear anywhere else, all year round on BBC Radio 3.
The Heroic Symphony, quite the nickname for this piece of music.
An opera here on Radio 3 that's a supreme example of Mozart's art.
We're your front row seat to the world's best live classical music. Listen on your radio, on BBC Sounds, and ask your smart speaker to play Radio 3.
And now, here on Radio 3, at 1:30, it's time for this week's edition of Music Map with Sarah Moore Peach.
Hello and welcome to BBC Radio 3's Music Map. This is the show where we pick a piece of classical music and go on a listening journey towards it. And usually, although we encounter lots of musical surprises along the way, we're working towards a well-known destination. But today is different, because you've probably never heard this piece before. Languishing in relative obscurity since its first performance in 1927, today's musical destination is this glorious concerto for violin, horn, and orchestra by the early 20th century English composer Dame Ethel Smythe. As we head towards a performance of the whole thing, we'll explore music from across the ages that connects to it in form, style, and also in relation to Smythe herself and her life story. And let's begin there, with the piece of music she's probably most famous for today, her suffrage anthem, The March of the Women.